listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Lyndon Wong. It's Thursday, March 14th at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
That's right. And on today's show, we're going to hear a piece produced by two Masters of Public Policy students on what makes an effective policy advocate and what makes an ineffective policy advocate and why that matters.
Sounds good. And after that, we're going to discuss the Vancouver Park Board's recent decision to open a warming center in DTES's Oppenheimer
Park. The downtown east side, in other words.
Yeah, Oppenheimer Park. And we'll end things off with a special in-studio interview with Alexander Kim, a producer on the new and overdose crisis podcast Crackdown. So let's go to a lesson on policy advocacy produced by News Collective member G.
Guillermo Rosales. No, his name's hard to pronounce. Here
Hello,
we go.
My name is Guillermo Rosales.
My name is Josh Tafel.
And we are both students at the Master of Public Policy and Global Affairs program at UBC. And today we're going to be talking about policy advocates and what makes a good policy advocate and what makes a bad one. But to begin with, let's start with defining public policy. Josh?
Sure thing. So public policy can be defined in many ways, but a general definition that comes from Dean Kilpatrick. Public policy can be generally defined as a system of laws, regulatory measures, courses of action, and funding priorities concerning a given topic promulgated by a governmental entity or its representatives.
So just to break that down for our listeners, just think about at work, every workplace has a type of code of conduct, values they believe in, or even a sexual harassment policy, a conflict of interest policy. You can find this documentation, I'm sure, and if you aren't aware of these things, definitely look them up because they're important at work. And they essentially are guidelines for regulating behaviors in work. But beyond this, as Josh has mentioned, they're guidelines and regulations for a multitude of many things, finances, not just behaviors, but institutional behaviors, organizational structures. For instance, I think workplace safety stems from the Workers' Compensation Act, a piece of law that says every employer needs to have some kind of safety measure in place in the form of a safety committee and kind of adjoining rules that ensure people are safe at work and in what they do. So you can think about working in a workplace such as a pool, you know, a maintenance person at a pool, you need to be aware of what are the dangerous aspects of the job, such as handling chlorine and other chemicals that go into pool maintenance. So now that we kind of got an idea of what generally public policy is, Josh, how could a public advocate or a policy advocate take form? Like, what would be a policy advocate? Who would be a policy advocate?
Right. Well, thanks for the question. Basically, a policy advocate, or a public policy advocate for that matter, it's any person or entity that is in a situation where they find themselves advocating for a certain policy that they want to get passed or a certain cause that they think is relevant in terms of the public sphere.
So let's take an example from America, maybe start with Trump. Could we call him a public policy advocate when he's saying we need to build a wall?
Sure, of course we can. Just because he's, you know, part of the government, he's probably the most important policy advocate in that sense.
And I guess to start there, we'll kind of consider, you know, like some key indicators for what makes a good policy advocate versus a bad one. So to start, I think with Trump and building a wall, he's making all these claims about building a wall, how it will keep the borders secure. But as we know, these claims he's made are being fact-checked and they are unsubstantiated and untrue. So as a first indicator, I think we're seeing is a bad policy advocate is going to gerrymander the truth. They're going to either lie outright, create alternative facts, or they're going to call into question things that are well established. In that situation, what else is kind of another indicator that makes a policy advocate less credible? Josh, what do you think?
Yeah, so that's certainly something. I just want to focus on that last thing that you said, because that could be glossed over pretty easily.
Yeah.
That calling into question something that's well established doesn't necessarily mean that a bad policy analyst. Mm-hmm. But especially with what you were talking about at the beginning, is someone, if you're using statistics in, you know, a malevolent way or hiding facts, that we say are not the truth, that would be an example of a bad policy advocate. There's sort of there's this idea that to be a policy advocate, since you're in the public sphere, you have to have some sort of ethic to your work. Mm-hmm. You have to have some sort of morality in that you are basically advocating for the truth, for the better of society.
Now, I kind of want to go back to this idea of facts being mm-hmm. true, because I think facts without context kind of mean nothing. It's kind of like looking down at a train track, mm-hmm. and you know the train track is there, you know there's a train, but which way does the train go, right? Without context, we don't know what the facts really mean. It's not like mathematics where it's, you know, kind of abstracted and we can always understand it. In other cases, we need context. So I think that's really important to peel apart in terms of how facts are used, because policy advocates will cherry pick facts. I think that's a reality. But bad ones really narrow their focus. They don't want other people to know all the facts. They focus on a few narrow facts and claim, you know, that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing in the States is a lot of that happening, right? Focusing on these narrow ideas, not presenting a full contextual picture, and just saying this is bad because of this fact. And kind of with that, like statistics. So I guess in terms of a policy advocate who isn't as good or who is bad, what are some key indicators for how they use statistics?
Sure. Well, it's hard to know sometimes whether all of the statistics are there, whether all of the facts are there.
Yeah.
I think there's sort of two ways that we can look at this. Is first of all, are all the facts there? Are all the relevant statistics being presented in a way that we can make up our mind about a certain issue? And the second thing is, are the conclusions that you're drawing from these statistics actually valid?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can say something like pick out any statistic and say that this means something. But if you're not, you have to look at that argument and see whether the statistics are actually causing your conclusion.
Right. The difference between causality and correlation.
Yep, that's definitely one.
So things are intertwined and they seem to be linked, but it doesn't mean there's a real conclusive link.
Mm-hmm.
So I think an example of this is this website known as TylerVegan.com. It's really great because it shows you all these statistics that correlate with one another. One statistic is the amount of people who eat ice cream, and then the amount of people who subsequently on a hot day also die by drowning.
Right.
So, of course, the implication to pull there is that if you eat ice cream on a hot, sunny day, you're more likely to drown. Now, it's interesting that these statistics correlate, but we have to remember, why are they correlating? Well, it's a summer month. More people are near bodies of water. And more people also like ice cream when it's hot out. So just because these two facts appeared to be linked doesn't mean they cause one another. And that's something we've learned in our statistics class, where mm-hmm. it's known as spurious correlations.
Yep.
We really want to be, I think, aware of when people make or throw statistics out there, you know, like you say, linking the statistic to the fact, making sure there's not just a correlation, but something stronger. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of things in life are correlated, but it doesn't mean they cause one another.
I want to bring this back to our main question about mm-hmm. like the ethic of the actual policy advocate itself.
Yeah.
Because I think that you can be, there's a difference between being a bad policy advocate and being a policy advocate that gets it wrong sometimes.
Right.
Right? And I think that difference is that the good policy advocate, or the, let's say, the moral policy advocate, takes into account these different, that there could be different explanations for something.
Right.
That there could be, you know, this is what we think right now, although we could be wrong, and actually being open to evidence that may come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just because you have to really take time to think about, do your conclusions follow from the premises?
Yeah.
And just because you're a little bit unsure, everybody is unsure to a degree about everything. I mean, you can, I guess what I'm saying is that you can get it wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
Admit that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that you're
a bad policy advocate
or a bad matter.
So I guess just to sum up so far, some key indicators for a bad policy advocate will be somebody who kind of starts at a very narrow scope and focus, who is unwilling to talk about other alternatives or larger contexts that bring about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's very narrowly defined, narrowly focused. They're cherry-picking facts. They're using sometimes very obscure and only once-tested statistics. Sometimes they're making up statistics completely. I think another key mm-hmm. indicator is that they will use a statistic and they will dance around or hide their source.
Right.
They will not be transparent with where they're getting their information. They will generally also try to redefine words. They will mess around with language. You know, this goes back to George Orwell's The Politics of Language. So I think all these key indicators are really good to watch out for when people in, you know, the public sphere, whether it be politicians, analysts, advocates at NGOs are making claims about an issue. You really want to consider, you know, what are they saying? How are they saying it? Where is this information coming from? Can I find it? Is it readily transparent and accountable? And is there a peer review of what their kind of sources and information is? Because if you're answering these questions and the answer to all of them is no, I think you have your answer that this person is not a very good policy advocate. Right. You're going to want to be more skeptical.
Yeah, you don't want to think twice.
But. Yeah, now let's turn to what would make a good policy advocate, Josh?
It's tough to say because almost all policy advocates have a goal in mind, right? Mm-hmm. They have a certain policy that they want to get passed for certain reasons. And sometimes it is tempting to withhold facts or spin something in the way that you want.
Yeah.
But generally, I would say a good policy advocate would see, in terms of just the moralization of it, would see the truth and the public good as something higher than your own motivations.
Right.
And your own goals in terms of policy or what you're trying to accomplish. And what that means is trying to look at all the facts of a situation.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, being transparent about where your sources are, being transparent about where you got your information,
yeah.
what your intentions are, what your motivations are, and trying to actually have a public discussion about something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one person holds truth. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I think a good example of a good policy advocate that I'd like to highlight here is the NGO in Vancouver, Good Night Out, or the Good Night Out campaign. So it was a small NGO initially started by two women looking simply to just make nights safer in the downtown Vancouver Granville Strip. Their main goal was just to make sure people got home safe. Now, initially, their big advocacy was just saying, we're going to create an implementable mechanism to make sure people are safer. What is that mechanism? We're going to create a volunteer group. We're going to walk around at night, you know, during Fridays, Saturdays, Thursday nights. We're going to wear clear red vests that say Good Night Out Vancouver, and we're going to approach people on the street and ask, you know, if they're alone, would you like an escort with this group to a taxi or to a bus stop, and we'll wait with you and make sure you get home, you know, onto your transportation safe. So I think that's an example of a good policy advocate, because simply they're not needing to present any facts. We know there's an issue with not just sexual assault, but just general assault on the Granville club scene, and their main goal is just to make sure people have a good night out, they get home safe, and they're transparent in that they're working in always a larger group to take people home. Since then, they've created a website that has a reporting mechanism so people can rate how well their experience was with their volunteers. But I think that would be a good example of a local good policy advocate, where we might not need something enshrined in regulation or law, but in their kind of goal and mission, they are helping to regulate some of the issues we've seen on the Granville kind of club scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's very unique about that case is they're also quite open about what their intentions are, what their motivations are, right? It's a group of volunteers.
And they've been working with a lot of other universities across Canada. From residence to residence, they'll escort people home to make sure they're safe. What are some other kind of maybe indicators that this policy advocate is better than not?
Well, I guess just if they're willing to have a discussion. Yeah. That's just a key takeaway, and willing to have a rational, respectful conversation about the policies that they're advocating for.
To generally sum it up, a better policy advocate will be open, transparent, tolerant. They'll display this physically and behaviorally. Mm-hmm. They are willing to show where their sources.
Mm-hmm.
Most of their sources will probably be peer-reviewed academically. Mm-hmm. They're going to present all sides. They're going to use all the facts, and they're going to synthesize that and present alternatives plus recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
So while they are advocating for one specific recommendation, they're also presenting these alternatives usually to their client or to the public of what we could be doing. Obviously, this can be really hard for politicians to do, as the public focus is kind of hard to rear in. And, you know, there's a lot of education needed to be done. But I think we've seen examples locally and nationally on this front where there's a discussion, it starts, people are getting educated on the issue, and finally we begin coming to some conclusions and recommendations. Do people follow through with the recommendations is kind of the next step.
Right.
I think we've kind of put together some good indicators for our listeners of what makes a better policy advocate and what makes a not so good policy advocate. Do you have any other final thoughts, Josh?
Try to be a better policy advocate, everyone.
Yeah, and just remember to consider asking questions when people are throwing certain facts out there. Mm-hmm. What is the whole picture? We're in a more interconnected world than ever, so a lot of information is out there. And if people are invested in certain issues, I think I would recommend to really dive deep, see what's out there, because, you know, issues and problems are never quite what they seem, and there's always two stories or more mm-hmm. stories to every kind of issue.
Exactly. No one person holds truth, and at the end of the day, you know, public policy is for the public good, so
yeah,
that's important to remember.
Excellent. All right, thank you. So please follow us at pubpoly.com for more policy issue research and thoughts, and you can also read our blogs as well on that website. Thank you so much, and that is all.
Thank you, folks.
Okay, so that was a piece on policy advocacy, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be back with more local news coverage after this short break.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year but will next year, and to our community as a whole. CITR and Discorder just want to say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so f-ing grateful.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Alex DeBoer. And Democracy Watch is our station's local independent news program.
So we just heard a piece on the influence policy advocates that on public perception of a multitude of different political issues. So let's turn our focus to some more local news now.
Our next motion on notice this evening is titled Oppenheimer Park Warming Shelter and Support Services. This motion is moved by Commissioner Irwin. Is there a seconder? Commissioner Giesbrecht has seconded.
So this Monday on March 11th, our city's Park Board approved several motions to improve conditions for those living in Vancouver's Oppenheimer Park, which is located in the downtown east side.
Yeah, so this motion, which passed, was put forward by COPE's Park Board Commissioner John Irwin. Irwin was essentially responding to the tent city in Oppenheimer Park, which has been there over the entire winter, which we've reported on and many other media organizations have reported on.
And just for a little bit more context, City Council has been waiting for the Park Board's decision on this.
Yeah.
And I've kind of cited that they want to see what the Park Board thinks before they push through any motions or mm-hmm. Any more support. So Council themselves just had last night heard from the public on the same topic, providing emergency shelter to people living in Oppenheimer Park. So the main difference between the council's motion and the motion that was passed on Monday by the Park Board is that the city's motion, which is put forward by Councillor Swanson, is meant to have more permanent effects on improving the lives of the people living in the park.
Yeah, so like, for example, differences between the Park Board's motion, which passed on Monday, and City Council's motion, which just had a public hearing, as Lyndon said, last night and has yet to be voted on, is that in the City Council motion, they want to rent a hotel or motel in the park. So that's like more permanent housing. They want to also have like storage for people's belongings and a way for people to access their belongings when they need them. So like more permanent facilities, whereas like in the Park Board motion, they voted to pass a temporary warming shelter and to have washrooms open and to keep looking into this issue. So that's like it has a little bit less permanence. So those are the key differences. And a lot of impassioned people spoke last night at City Hall, largely in favor of having real permanent housing in Oppenheimer Park. A lot of people were very upset at the idea of even having, say, like large tents be a temporary solution. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, like, you know, outside of the warming tents, mm-hmm. another specific issue that I think that has been highlighted on was that people in Oppenheimer Park claimed that their personal belongings were being taken away and destroyed by park staff.
Yeah, totally. And this is in part, this ties in with, I think it's every day, every few days, park board staff had to go in and instruct folks living in Oppenheimer's tent city to deconstruct their tents, take everything away, and then they have to reconstruct them. And in part, this is an act of safety. It's meant to keep people safe from like a fire if folks have flammable materials, a lighter, propane, whatever. Those items are meant to be removed. But in the sort of chaos of this, you know, daily or weekly event, people's stuff would get stolen. Yeah, that's been a big issue, like you said, that folks in the park have been talking about. In addition to that, of course, Commissioner Irwin, who proposed this motion to Park Board, was citing this as one of the, you know, reasons why we need to pass this motion. And it was interesting to actually hear, because Commissioner Cooper, who is with the MPA party, expressed quite clearly his uncertainty about whether the claims that people's possessions were going missing were in fact valid.
People who generated the information.
Okay, so as a follow-up, it would be fair to say that you have not checked with our staff, city staff, or the VPD to verify that those statements are in fact correct. Is that correct?
No, I did read the memo very closely from our staff, which came after this.
So that was Commissioner Cooper. He also questioned why Oppenheimer Park campers didn't go to any of the shelters instead, and Commissioner Irwin responded.
Yeah, he seems pretty unconvinced, so let's hear another clip.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that you were also aware in the memo that we received from our general manager, spaces that are pet-friendly and certainly are open during the period that you're talking about. Would you not prefer to see people go into shelter than stay in a park in a tent?
I think most of us would prefer that, but there's obviously, I don't know if it's necessarily hard to house, or that maybe a family of six, you know, feels that they'll get broken up or not have their privacy in a shelter, and I don't know. I always think, you know, there, but for the good grace of, you know, God or the Creator or good luck, go I. And would I necessarily, you know, want to go into a shelter? You know, I think it's one of those tough issues. You know, there's clearly a group of people who tend not to want to go into a shelter. And of course, that means it's not our jurisdiction, but we need to get people housed. That's the ultimate answer.
Yeah, so that was Commissioner Irwin responding to a question from Commissioner Cooper. Cooper also tabled a motion to refer Irwin's motion on emergency shelters back to staff. So this motion failed 5-7, with only the two MPA Park Board commissioners voting in favor of it.
Yeah, so Commissioner Cooper was kind of checking in with Irwin to make sure he had conferred with city staff and confirmed these reports that stuff was being stolen and that people didn't want to go to shelters. And Irwin sort of said, like, you know, yeah, we could like verify this more, but I have heard from many people who I trust that this is the case. Despite that answer, Commissioner Cooper did still, as you said, ask or table a motion to, you know, put this emergency motion back to staff. And it's like, it's interesting because the whole point is that it's an emergency motion.
Yeah.
And so urgency is of the essence. So sort of unsurprisingly, Park Board voted his motion to send this motion back to staff down. And the only two people who voted in favor of it were the two NPA members of the park board.
Yeah, and also just adding on to that, there was like a lot of push for this type of emergency by the residents of Oppenheimer Park.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But again, Cooper felt city staff hadn't verified some of the things Erin was saying mm-hmm. and wanted things to be done more thoroughly, I suppose.
Yeah.
He also asked why nearby warming centers were enough for tent dwellers, even though, you know, it is a good amount of distance away.
Yeah, there were lots of reasons cited why people didn't prefer to go to warming centers or shelters. In the clip we just played, Erwin, you know, listed some of them, like people who have families or who have partners. They can't go and sleep together in a shelter. If you have pets, you can't bring your belongings, all those reasons that we've covered. Another thing that Cooper brought up was that he was concerned with the section of this motion, which directs staff to keep a washroom and warming facility open for 24 hours in Oppenheimer Park. And a comment he made about this, why he thought it might be difficult to do that, was that providing this kind of overnight staffing in Oppenheimer Park might be precarious due to the neighborhood. He was basically alluding to it's a dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah. But despite his opposition to a lot of these policies or these amendments, there was a reasonable amount of support for both the heating tents by the counselors and the 24-hour washrooms, with support from Councillor McKinnon.
And I will support this amendment, and very specifically because parks are places for all people. And when people are forced due to circumstances to set up a tent or some sort of shelter in a park, which I understand, they are also denying others access to that park for those purposes. And so I would like to see whether there is other land available in that neighborhood that city owned where the encampment could move to, so that we could have people tenting as necessary, but we could still have access to the park as a park. So I will support the amendment.
So that was, you just heard Park Board Chair Stuart McKinnon. As you hear, he was, you know, he was in support of this, but parts of his statement was then corrected by Councillor Erwin.
Right, so we're going to hear that correction.
Yeah. I'm supportive of the amendment, but my understanding was that it would just be the warming station, though. So, you know, maybe I'm not reading it correctly. Because it's implement a warming station in Oppenheimer Park or other city-owned land. So I don't think we necessarily want to deal with, removal unless we're going down another road altogether, right? I just want to.
Yeah, but alongside him, Commissioner Demers also voiced his support for this motion.
Right, so that was just a minor, like, misunderstanding. Okay, and then Commissioner Demers had reasons to support, so we'll hear that.
I will be happy to support this amendment as well. I'd like to echo the words by Chair McKinnon and add that to me, this amendment is one of maybe many that shows and loops the city back in this, or the situation we have to deal with it now. But it's a situation where there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of people involved. I think it's been made very clear. And this does exactly that. Bring the city back in.
Right. So that was Commissioner Demers of the Green Party. And so we also had Commissioner Gwen Giesbrick, who's also with COPE, in addition to John Erwin. And she made a noteworthy comment, which was that she was happy to support Erwin's motion, in part because of the importance of finding place-based strategies for dealing with homelessness. I thought this was something to highlight. So what she was saying is that it'll be more effective to build shelter in the park, in Oppenheimer Park, where people have, for whatever reason, chosen to live, based on obviously limited options, rather than, say, forcing those people to go, 10 blocks down the street to whatever location. She feels that this is a better strategy.
Yeah. So in the end, Commissioner Oren's motion passed. Three of the four sections passed unanimously. But with Section A, you know, as seen previously, it was opposed by both MPA commissioners. And that section states that park board staff work with city staff to temporarily implement a warming station in Oppenheimer Park or other city-owned land within close proximity with large heated tents.
Right. And I just wanted to add, like, so in sum, the actual motion that was passed has that Section A that you just said, which was voted against by both MPA councillors. But then the three other sections, Section B, C, and D, were voted unanimously in favor by all park board commissioners. And so the sections B, C, and D include also, in addition to building a warming station in Oppenheimer Park, providing washroom facilities, which includes a 24-hour access to the warming station. And this motion also instructs staff to explore options so campers can keep their possessions on site securely without having them stolen, and instructs staff to continue communicating with city staff about other possible solutions to humanize the experience of being homeless.
Yeah, and so that kind of concludes this park board meeting summary. And all right, so you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going back with an in-studio interview with producer Alex Kim of the new overdose epidemic podcast Crackdown after a couple of PSAs. Stay tuned.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year but will next year, and to our community as a whole. CITR and Discorder just want to say...
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Hello, you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Sorry for the random music. Our broadcasting program stopped working, which is so fun. It's so fun being in community radio. It is, but sometimes that happens, and it is tough. So I played a CD that I found by someone named Akabo Jiu. So that's cool. Hope you liked it.
I liked it.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. So I don't know if I said this, but my name's Alex DeBoer, and I'm joined in studio by Alexander Kim.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So today on Democracy Watch, we've talked about policy advocacy as well as the Vancouver Park Board's recent vote to build a warming center in Oppenheimer Park. Now we have Alex in studio. Alex is a UBC journalism school student. He's also a freelance journalist and a producer for the Vancouver-based podcast Cited. He's also a producer on an exciting new podcast called Crackdown.
That's right, yeah.
Yep. Crackdown is a podcast all about the opioid crisis. It's hosted by Garth Mullins, an activist, radio producer, and opioid user. And before I start asking you about Crackdown, I wanted to play a little preview of the podcast that you sent me so that our listeners can kind of get a taste of what the podcast sounds like. Here we go.
See, there's the real background to my hood. That's the reality of my hood, is that that's the ever-present reminder that you are always playing Russian roulette every time you use a drug down here nowadays, which is pathetic when we know that we could have a safe drug supply.
If it's Russian roulette, why do we do it? Many reasons. Avoiding dope sickness is a big one. Now, I've done some dodgy things to avoid that dope sickness. Like this one time, I'd spent the rent. There's an eviction notice on the door of my apartment, and I'm dope sick. Cold chemical sweat is dripping down my back. At a pawn shop not far from here, I sell the boots off my feet. Wet November pavement seeping up through my socks was just the price of doing business that day. Drugs can blot out, if just for a moment, the trauma of colonization, or a partner's violence, or the drudgery of work, or the terror of homelessness, or the brutality of racism. Drugs can dull the pain of injuries we got on the job. And also, drugs just feel good.
All right. Thanks for sharing that clip, Alex Kim.
Of course.
Sounds really good. Who did the sound design?
Myself and my colleague Sam Fenn, who's just a wizard with all things sound. And he made that music too, the music that was playing.
Yes. Yeah. It's very good. Sam is the best. yeah. So let's just start off by maybe you just explaining for our listeners maybe slightly more in depth what Crackdown is, what it's all about.
Sure. So it's a new podcast. We've only put out two episodes now, relatively new, really new. And it's a show about drugs and drug policy and drug activism. And a big part of the idea is that it's media, it's stories told about drugs and the drug war by and from the perspective of drug users. So Garth hosts the show. The show is largely about his sort of, from his point of view. We also have an editorial board made up of longtime activists from the downtown east side and drug users, people from Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, BC Association of People on Methadone, Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, some other organizations as well. So, it's kind of like it's media about the war on drugs made by the people most affected by it.
Right, which is pretty radical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
When it comes to reporting on something like the opioid crisis, to actually have it be done by or advised by the community itself. So you said you have two episodes out. The podcast is coming out once a month. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Last Wednesday of the month is our release schedule.
Right. And so the first episode is called War Correspondence, which is a title that obviously fits in with the colloquial phrase, the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a bit on that title and why you chose it for the first episode.
The first episode had a couple different titles at different points. And I think we settled on War Correspondence because to a lot of the people whose perspectives you'll hear on the show and whose stories you'll hear on the show, the drug policy that is being carried out across North America and the world, they really do experience it as a war on drug users and their communities. And so we wanted to highlight that and to focus to have that there as like a reminder to focus on what kinds of stories we want to tell. Like we want to cover the drug war as if we were war correspondents. Yeah.
Right, totally. And from listening to the two episodes you have out, the sense I've gotten is that I would basically like categorize this podcast as kind of activism journalism, where it is the subject is approached with this like urgency and immediacy of lives being at stake, which they literally are.
Mm-hmm.
As a journalist, how do you kind of deal with that, bringing in that sort of subjectivity and that sort of biased passion, which is basically the same thing as subjectivity, just said in a different way.
Right. Yeah. No. We think about this project as advocacy journalism,
mm-hmm.
and activism, as well as journalism, which might sound contradictory, but the way that I think about it is that I think on no other project I've worked on has it been so clear to me like who the community is that I'm supposed to be serving with my journalism. Like I've done journalism before for the CBC, for different people. But it's less clear at times like the importance of what you're doing, booking an interview for the afternoon show or whatever, and like what importance it is. But
totally.
On this project, we've oriented our whole ethics around serving a particular community, and we're happy to be like explain where we're coming from and say and like show you what people from this community experience and what they think and why they think it. I think that's essentially our ethics.
Right. Well, and what you're saying, it is it is a difference from a lot of journalists' experience where, you know, you're assigned to report on something or you choose to report on something, but you're not embedded in that community. And when you are accountable to a board of folks, like you said, from VanDoo, from different Downtown Eastside organizations, many of whom are drug users, and you're, you know, meeting with them, like I know you guys do, you play cuts of the episode for the board and get feedback, right? So you have, like, you are producing journalism with a community that is about that community. So,
and we want, yeah, like, we actually play, we hold listening parties before we release each episode, not just for the board. Pardon me. oh my God. And, but for anyone at VanDoo, who wants to come and listen. And, yeah, we solicit feedback, and it's really important for us to, for that it does, like, play in that room in the Downtown East Side, because a lot of people in the Downtown East Side, you might guess, like, don't listen to podcasts all that much. And, like, we want to make sure that that it comes back to them, that what they hear sounds like it's reflective of their experiences. And we want to know what they think and what we should be doing different. Yeah.
And so while the podcast is about this community and reflective of them and taking a lot of steps to make sure that it is accurate and reflective and collaboratively made, it's not like your goal audience is someone else, right? Like, what do you want listeners to get out of this podcast? Who are your listeners, and what do you want sort of the result of this podcast series to be, if you have any result in mind?
I guess we think about the audience as this, like, wider world of anybody who cares about this public health disaster that is happening all across North America and the world. That could, that we've, like, based on the feedback that we're getting online and stuff, like, a lot of different communities, like, a lot of doctors are interested in this. So we get a lot of feedback from doctors who are interested in harm reduction and in opioids and stuff like that. Family members of people who have been personally touched by the opioid crisis, the overdose crisis. But in terms of, like, who we're trying to reach, like, I think we're trying to reach everybody in a way. Everybody who doesn't already, who hasn't already been converted, who doesn't already know about the disaster that's happening right now. And we want people to get angry. We want people we want to be part of building a mass movement against the war on drugs.
Right.
And for, for stopping people from dying, hopefully.
Yeah. Admirable goal.
thank you.
And so, like, what you were saying about getting feedback from doctors and community members, that ties in really with episode 2 a lot, which was, I forget, what's the title of episode 2?
It's called Change Intolerance. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so the focus of this episode is on something that's really interesting and I think very underreported, if reported on at all, which is just, I won't get into it in depth, but it's that there's a methadone program in place in Canada that's available to some drug users in place of doing an opioid like heroin. So in about 2014, the methadone people were given was switched to a different drug called methadose.
Not a different drug, but a different formulation of methadone called methadose, which is made by a company called Mallinckrodt, and it's like a patented formulation of the drug.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this different formulation actually was far less effective than methadone, which was reported by a lot of these patients or drug users who were taking it. Like, they were like, oh, you know, they'd take it and be dope sick, like, a few hours later. It didn't have the weight, the, like, it didn't last the way methadone was. And as a result, a lot of people ended up turning back to heroin. And, you know, when they get back into that kind of drug, they have to get on the street. That means often
It means returning to, like, a black market and all the all the hazards of the black market, especially right now when the drug supply is extremely dangerous and
contaminated. Yeah. So, you know, we have all that, and that has led to people dying. Mm. And this is really just crazy because – and what's crazy about it that you outline in the episode, or that, you know, you and Garth and Sam make clear in the episode, is that patients and who are drug users were telling their doctors, this is happening to me. Like, this drug isn't working. And there were even doctors that did studies, right? Or folks who were doing studies, academics, saying, like, I've done this test group. And they all say that, like, this drug isn't working.
Yeah. Well, so the change happened in 2014. And I should mention also that my colleague, Sam, who I mentioned earlier, led reporting on this episode, and he did a great job
covering
a lot of stuff. The change happened in 2014. At the time, there was around 15,000 methadone patients in BC. Today, it's closer to 25,000. And for virtually everybody who is on methadone maintenance therapy in the province, they just got switched without any choice or warning to a different formulation of methadone. And then a lot of people started to notice that it didn't seem to work as well. And when people would mention it to their doctors, doctors would try different things. As far as we knew, like, it was the same drug and should be working the same way. And also, like, you know, from doctor's point of view, when you're dealing with pain patients or patients who have addiction problems, they tend to not be believed as much as other patients. It's really stigmatized, population, and the way that they receive medical treatment is very fraught. Because here in Vancouver there's a group called BCAPOM, a group of politically organized methadone users, they started to meet and notice that, like, oh, it's all happening to all of us. There's something going on here. No one's really believing us. And they ended up bringing in researchers from the BC Center on Substance Use who started doing studies, ethnographic studies, public health studies on methadone patients, and confirmed that illicit opioid use went way up after the switch, that people went back to the street, started chipping again. This could have all been avoided if there was some way that if someone had asked before the switch had happened, or given anyone a choice, or listened when patients were reporting that the medication wasn't working as well. And to this day, it's still methadose that's really pretty much only available in this province, and there's a shortage of other drugs. The province has refused to, like, as of till now, they've not done anything to remedy the situation, and people are still dealing with a medication that a lot of people find doesn't work for them.
Yeah, it's like unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's crazy. The importance of getting that story out can't be understated. And something I thought about when I was listening to it is, like you said, these patients aren't being believed because generally there's stigma around drug users. And what it really showed to me was, like, in our society, we, especially in, like, Vancouver, we're seen as being, you know, quite progressive on this, on the war on drugs, in that we had created the first safe injection site in North America, which is Insight. We also, even just having a program like having methadone available as an alternative to heroin, that's so progressive of us.
Yeah, in some parts of the world, like, yeah, it's methadone in a lot of places in the world and nothing else, or you may not even have access to any kind of opioid replacement therapy, which methadone is one of, maybe the most popular. Yeah.
Right, so, like, we have these, like, acts of, you know, taking a different approach to the war on drugs, trying to move towards maybe a day when drugs are legal. But anyway, while we've taken these steps, they're really superficial in so many ways because we have these methadone programs, but the doctors don't even listen to the patients. Like, but the program didn't actually properly, you know, confer with drug users to ensure that this new formulation of methadone called methadose actually worked. Like, it's all sort of, oh, yeah, we did this, but, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's working or not. Mm-hmm. Like, the depth of our desire to actually make change and save the lives of drug users is very shallow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's something that we want to remember in making this show is we've described it before as like a Vancouver exceptionalism, kind of.
What does that mean?
What that means to us is like that we can't forget that, like, that one, we live in a city where the Overton window on drugs is really different from a lot of places, but two,
what is that? The Overton
window? The Overton window, I mean, that's like the range of sort of like acceptable mainstream political discourse. You know what I mean? So like when you like widen, when you like
right.
move the Overton window to the left, you're like moving it more to like
right.
more
so
left.
We're
stuff
open
gets,
to discussion about like
yeah, yeah.
changing the war on drugs.
Maybe I'm not even using this term correctly. Anyway. yeah. So one, we don't want to get like, we don't want to forget that living here in Vancouver, we're talking to a lot of people in a lot of different places where the context is totally different. And we don't want to forget that it's not all, like, we don't want to pat ourselves on the back so much and forget that.
Yes.
Because the problem isn't solved. Like, it's still incredibly messed up here. And there's so much more that we know we can do and, like, know what to do to solve the problem. And we don't want to forget that. So that's kind of what I mean by Vancouver exceptionalism.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I'm just conscious of the time. We just have a minute left here. But could you tell me any, I don't know if you're able to, but if so, can you tell me a bit about the next episode that's coming out? Crackdown.
Yeah, the next episode that's in production now is going to be about peer-led responses to the opioid crisis. So yeah, it's kind of like, so the story with Insight, right, is like Insight's now like a fully like authorized facility by, you know, legal under everything. But it didn't start that way. Like, it started as an underground illegal place where you could go do drugs safely. And it was activists who were breaking the law to set this place up. And a lot of them were peers, like people who do drugs. And they were doing it to save each other because they live in a community, they care about each other, and the first responders to the crisis are the people within the community themselves. And this is where we find a lot of solutions and answers to the opioid crisis. So, yeah, this episode is all about peer-led responses to the overdose crisis. I don't know what else I can say. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I mean, it's still in production.
Yeah.
But that's really interesting. I didn't actually know that about Insight. And So
Needle Exchange, the same is true.
Okay.
Like, Anne Livingston used to drive around in a van handing out needles in front of cops, like essentially daring them to arrest her. Anne's a badass.
Yeah, she's an important activist, definitely. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Of course,
Alex,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, can you tell people where they can find Crackdown?
Sure. We're on all the podcast services. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher. Our website is
on Spotify too, I think.
I think we are on Spotify now. Our website is crackdownpod.com.
Cool.
We're also on Twitter and stuff.
Also on Twitter. Great. Well, thanks again, and thank you to our listeners. This is Alex DeBoer signing out on Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Please stay tuned for more great independent local programming, and thanks again for tuning in.